And we're not going to belabor the introduction here, but I know it's going to be a little disconcerting for some of you to listen to and see our honored guest this evening. So if you would feel better going and listening to your listening to this in your car and sitting in traffic, I will understand.
Can I, my predecessor in this gig, Robert Siegel, has a great line where he looks out at the crowd and says, "You don't look like I thought you would either." I can't top it.
Well, and quite frankly, we should be honored that you have chosen to visit us in Milwaukee, because you are maybe the only person I have ever met who has been to Pyongyang before you came to Wisconsin.
True story. This is my first day ever in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin altogether, so thank you. Thank you for the warm welcome.
Well, so welcome to Milwaukee. Thank you for getting, I don't know if you had to get those boots out of the attic, but I know the boots you were wearing earlier today had been put away in the attic for a while. Let me start. I mean, you were the national security correspondent before you were All Things Considered host. How do you get to learn to be a national security correspondent without actually being a spy?
Ah, that you know of. No, I'm not a spy. Excellent first question. I was saying to a couple of people here tonight, my degree from university is in foreign relations, and I'd always wanted to do international news. When I first came to NPR, I kind of weaseled my way into a stint filling in behind Michelle Kellerman, who then as now was diplomatic correspondent. She went on maternity leave. They needed somebody to fill in. This was 2002, 2003, so post 9/11, run up to Iraq War, tons going on. And I remember, like it was yesterday, having this moment sitting in a State Department briefing. This is when Colin Powell was running State, and listening to whatever they were briefing. I think it was Pakistan and what was going on there, efforts to find bin Laden, and thinking, huh, this is not where the action is in U.S. foreign policy. This is not, it's important, don't get me wrong, diplomacy, but in terms of where the U.S. is leveraging power, it's going on through military channels and intelligence channels and covert channels. When you look at what's actually changing events on the ground in a place like Pakistan, I'm curious what's going on outside the State Department. And we didn't have anybody covering it full time. We were covering it through the Pentagon, the White House, State, other places. And when I came back from maternity leave and pitched, we launched the intelligence beat. And I had absolutely no idea what I was doing, had not a single source, and just started figuring it out, covering the bread and butter stories and trying to get them right, and then coming back the next day and just plugging away.
Is there a certain freedom in doing something like this without a syllabus there?
Yes. So this is the, if you cover one of the big beats in Washington, you know, the White House, Capitol Hill, the Supreme Court even, you get a hard pass and you can go every day. And there's a place where you can file from there and you run into people. When I covered the Pentagon, it blew my mind that you get a hard pass, you can go, and if you're trying to get a certain general to talk to you, you can, you know, he might dodge your calls, but you can go stand outside the men's room, and eventually he's going to walk in or out, and you can put your question to him. Which, needless to say, when you're covering the CIA or the National Security Agency, you can't do. And so that was a learning curve. There's no directory. You can't go. They don't tell you when they're traveling. You certainly can't travel with them. They don't do daily press briefings. You have no idea what's going on, but it does free you in the sense that there's no agenda. I mean, they're up to all kinds of interesting things behind the scenes, and you're not in the press pack in the way that when you cover, say, the White House, and there's clearly a story of the day, and you got to get, you know, you got to file for newscast and All Things Considered, and then Morning Edition the next day on it. You have a little bit more space and running room. And that has always really appealed to me about covering national security.
I think a lot of us have this idea that people in the intelligence field are entirely about subterfuge, and reporting on them would make for a really challenging task. How do you evaluate the information that you get from a source in the intelligence field?
Right. The CIA is a clandestine intelligence service. their job is to steal secrets and operate in ways outside the US that are not always in compliance with the local laws, I'll put it that way. So you're always aware of that. There's zero upside for them in talking to someone like me. Why would they do it? And I was sharing at lunch today, you know, one of the things that made a huge impression on me early on when I was starting this beat is if you work at CIA, National Security Agency, wherever, you have a security clearance where you're regularly polygraphed, and one of the regular questions is, have you had any contact with the media? And so when I'm trying to get a source to tell me something, they are risking their income, their job, to do so, risking losing their clearance. So you think through that, you know, very carefully as you're making your way. The how do you evaluate it? I have learned the hard way. You can have the best source in the world. I was thinking about this after the whole fiasco over Iraq and pre-war intelligence. You could have talked to Colin Powell, then Secretary of State, a seasoned general who had access to the most top secret intelligence the US had the day before he briefed the UN Security Council, laying the groundwork for the US-led invasion, and you would have gotten completely faulty intelligence because that's what he had. How do you correct for that? One of the things I've learned to do is always, always ask, how do you know that? So you get somebody on the phone, they tell you something interesting, it squares with what you know. You know, before you let them go, how do you know that? Did you see the document? Were you in the meeting? What happened next? Because I've had experiences where I have a source, and this, to speak, just to digress for a second, I have almost never, even covering this beat, had someone who I thought was deliberately trying to mislead me. That doesn't mean they were telling me everything they knew, not by a long shot, but they weren't. You know, CIA public affairs, I have never had someone who I thought was going out of their way to steer me wrong. In fact, the opposite. But the how do you know that question, because I've had sources who, they only know what they know. You know, unlike my reporting, your journalism, where if I get something wrong in a story, which is hopefully rare, but I'm going to hear about it, because people like you will call and yell, and we'll correct it immediately and correct the transcript and try to put it right, and there's daylight, there's sunshine on that. In reporting on classified intelligence, there's not. It's classified. Nobody else gets to see it, even other people operating with security clearances. So you can be talking to someone who is a great source, who was in the crucial meeting, who has read the crucial document, who maybe even, you know, agrees to read you a couple of paragraphs verbatim from the document. But they don't know about the meeting that was called 2 hours later at which the guidance from the first one was rescinded or at which a new memo was put out. So people, you know, only know what they know. So how do you know that question? I ask over and over and over. And often that leads to a fascinating question, you know. The next story, how do you know that? Oh, because of this meeting, you know, at the White House yesterday. Oh, what was that? Next story.
And at the same time, do you ever worry about how your reporting might have fit in terms of advancing the aims of one intelligence community or another?
Something I have almost never experienced is a senior official at the Pentagon or the White House or the CIA who is talking to me purely out of the goodness and light of their heart because they really care that I break a big story and get the next promotion. You know, everybody has an agenda. I have asked that question, why are you telling me this? What do you want me to know? One of the, you know, other kind of techniques that's, I hope, served me well and continued to is asking really basic questions. Again, when you're covering something that can be as complicated, acronym and jargon laden as, you know, covering things in the defense and security worlds, asking the really basic, whose job is that? Who pays for that? So one quick example, I had been covering this beat for a few years, and I must have been, I don't know, 2009, 2010, and an editor asked me, can you do an update on the hunt for bin Laden? Why can't we find him? Where is he? And my heart kind of sank because I'd done that story five or six times by now. They can't find him because they don't know where he is, and he's in these, you know, tribal areas, they think, Afghanistan, Pakistan, it's hostile terrain, he practices great operational security, he's never on the sat phone, et cetera. How many different ways can I do this story? They just can't find him. And I decided to ask the question, like, whose job is that to find him? And I know that, you know, it's a whole of government effort and people at the CIA and the White House, and Pentagon, there's all these different players involved in that, but whose actual job is it to wake up every morning and find bin Laden? And I was putting this question to a source, and I kept putting it to him, and the source finally got exasperated and said, look, it's, you know, we're all working on it. It's not anybody's job. And I said, well, you know, the bin Laden unit at CIA, they must be working on this. It must be their job. And he kind of looked at me and said, you should ask them about that. And I didn't. It turned out it had just been reorganized out of existence, which was a big story that caused Senate hearings and all this. But it's the basic, whose job is that? Like, who does that? I feel like I should know that because I cover this beat. I don't know who. I don't know. And it turns out nobody does.
How do you square the kind of stuff that you're trying to bring to light in reporting like that versus what we hear Julian Assange accused of?
A timely question.
I think I was listening to it on All Things Considered today.
So David Folkenflik had a story, which I didn't hear. I saw it up on the rundown that he was doing a journalist versus whistleblower, you know, that conversation. So I've interviewed Julian Assange. I don't actually feel like it's my role to weigh in on the, is he a traitor, is he a whistleblower, is he a journalist, in part because those labels are so, no, my husband's a lawyer. You can argue, he's a great lawyer, he's a bad lawyer, I like his tactics in court, I don't, you're not going to dispute that he's a lawyer, because he's a lawyer. There's a, you know, a JD, and he had to go get it, and then pass the bar. A journalist, like, what's the definition of journalism? Collecting, writing, editing, processing, sharing news in the service of an informed citizenry, something like that. I see the role of a journalist and what I do as being separate from what WikiLeaks has done. I would distinguish it in the sense that I'm not performing a service as a journalist if I'm just collecting every piece of data I can and dumping it out there without any effort to fact check, without any effort to assess whether there are sources and material in there that should, for legitimate reasons, be kept out of the public domain. I mean, bottom line, just assess, is this true or not? Is it true or not? Because who in this room has read every document that WikiLeaks has posted? I mean, nobody. Who has time? That's not your job. That is a journalist's job, to go through and assess. And that's something that WikiLeaks hasn't done. That's a separate question from, should he be extradited? Should he be tried? Should he be charged? Has he ultimately served the public good? And I could argue that in a bunch of different ways.
And there is probably not a serious journalist in the world who has not had a certain amount of existential angst about thinking through the whole WikiLeaks story, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially on a day like today, where we wait to see how this is going to play out, and will he ever see the inside of a courtroom in the U.S.? I don't know.
So, flashing forward from your time as national security correspondent a little bit, you are filling in as All Things Considered host back in 2017. When the word comes that your boss, the lead news person at NPR, Michael Oreskes, has been implicated in a report about sexual harassment or straight-up misconduct, and I say the word comes out, but how did you first hear about it?
That was an interesting week at NPR. Michael Oreskes was the head of news at NPR. He actually hired me back. I left NPR to pursue writing fiction full-time for a number of years, and he brought me back in 2016 to cover the intelligence beat. And I was filling in on All Things Considered. So it was in Studio 31, which if you had the chance to tour headquarters, is the big studio that All Things Considered and Morning Out Edition goes out of every day. I was hosting that day with Ari Shapiro, who turned to me at some point fairly early in the show and said, "Oh my God, have you seen what the Washington Post just posted to their website?" I said, "No." And we looked, and it's a big investigative story detailing numerous complaints of sexual harassment against Michael Oreskes, predating his period as NPR news chief. And Ari and I, our jaw hit the floor, and you know, we very quickly launched, I did a live interview with David Folkenflik, our media correspondent, who had already gotten a more recent complaint that advanced the reporting the Post had done, a current NPR producer who had submitted a complaint 2 years previously that had gone through the Office of General Counsel and HR and made its way up to the CEO, and Mike had been reprimanded, but it had not ever, I knew nothing of it. By that night, Mike had been put on leave. We came back in the next morning, and it was the talk of the newsroom, as you can imagine. More women were coming forward by that point and reporting complaints. And the tipping point for me was I went down to get a salad and was standing in the lunch line trying to pay for it in the NPR cafeteria, skimming through my phone. And a news alert flashes up from the AP, the Associated Press, saying Mike Oreskes is out. Asked to resign at NPR. And something just, I was infuriated at, you know, what was being alleged and the repulsiveness of it, but also, why am I standing in the middle of NPR reading about what's going on at NPR on the AP and from the Washington Post? Come on, I mean, I am a competitive journalist. What is up with that? Why are we getting scooped on this? The only person who could answer that question was our CEO, Yarol Mohn. And I went to the executive producer of All Things Considered, Carlene Watson. She still runs All Things Considered, and said, "I think we should interview Yarol on air today." And she looked at me like, "Are you out of your mind?" But was supportive and said, "Okay." And we went and talked to the managing editor on duty, who also looked at me like I was insane. But it was, you know, it was snapping on news wires across the country. It was a national story in our newsroom. Like, how can we not cover that? And I had all these questions. How did you know? When did you know? What did you know? Why didn't we know? Why are we getting scooped? What are you going to do about it? How are you going to prevent this from happening going forward? So we put in an official interview request, as any other news organization would do, to speak to Yarol. And to my somewhat surprise, he accepted, and within an hour, we were sitting down back in Studio 31. And I interviewed him for 15, 20 minutes, right before. We did not do it live, but at 3:15 in the afternoon for a segment that was airing in the 4 o'clock hour. It was, I hope, professional, gracious, but I was determined that we get some answers. And I shared, we had a chat in the WUWM newsroom today, and I got asked about it, and I said two quick things. One, I think it was very important to NPR that we do that. It was an empowering response from the newsroom. We are journalists. We will cover ourselves with the same rigor and transparency as we would cover this if it happened at any other news organization. And all credit to Yarol for agreeing to sit down and do it, because he didn't have to. I think in the end, it was positive both within NPR and outside. I haven't seen another news organization do that. I haven't seen somebody sit down and interview the head of CBS about Charlie Rose or the head of NBC about Matt Lauer. The fact that NPR allowed it to happen and then aired it and had no editorial say over it speaks to the rigor of the newsroom. The second point I will make was just, and this is what I said in our conversation earlier, when I am questioning someone on All Things Considered, this sounds corny, but I'm doing it for all of you. I mean, those people, if I'm interviewing a senator or a White House official, they're not taking my questions. They're taking questions on behalf of the audience that they'll reach at NPR. And I'm always conscious of that, and it has given me courage in numerous difficult interviews where somebody is being an ass and refusing to answer the questions and dodging it. And I just think it would be easier just to move on, but you deserve an answer. And I felt that very powerfully interviewing Jarl, because I think there are a lot of women in a lot of newsrooms and a lot of offices everywhere who deserve and would like to be able to question their boss over conduct that was just not acceptable, that we have all put up with for a long time, and to be able to say, when did you know? What did you know? Why didn't this give you pause? Why didn't you do something to stop it? You knew my colleagues were at risk. And what are you gonna do to stop it going forward? How are we gonna change this? How can I help you change it? I felt like I was asking that for all the women in the NPR newsroom. And I know that I was asking that for all the women in the NPR newsroom, because the newsroom came to a standstill during that interview. And there were a couple hundred people lined up outside. The speakers were turned on, and everybody who wasn't on air doing newscasts or something, going out immediately, was there listening. And it was important.
We often think of that journalism maxim, with the idea that as journalists we're here to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, but it is not often that the afflicted are our coworkers.
Yeah, it's not a conversation I had ever hoped or wanted to find myself in, for obvious reasons. Not an easy conversation to have, but a necessary one, and a reminder that if you are sincere and honest and respectful, you can ask just about anybody, just about any damn anything. And they can answer or not as they like.
Well, and I don't know how much insight people in this room have in terms of the sense of discontent that I gather was coursing through the veins of the NPR newsroom at the time. But how does the culture there feel today versus the fall of 2017?
Much calmer. The process of Mike leaving was abrupt. And then Jarl, as our CEO, went on medical leave within a week, 2 weeks. So the head of the newsroom and the head of NPR overall were both absent from our daily operations for an extended period of time. And there were more allegations against other male staffers, one or two of whom who left, one or two of whom had additional training and have returned to the job. So a difficult time, a time in which we saw real generational differences emerging, the women who were pioneers at NPR, who are now in their 60s, 70s, and older, came at this from a very different perspective than the millennials. And that was really interesting to hear those conversations. We, as of, 4 months ago, have a new head of news. The permanent successor to Michael Oreskes, Nancy Barnes, has arrived, and she's been wrapping her head around how we do what we do. She's new to broadcasting and has been learning that, and we're waiting to see what her vision going forward will be. She is very into investigative enterprise reporting, and the conversations I have had with her so far have been focused on, it's easy to say, hard to do. We all want to do distinctive coverage that's original and not just follow the herd. But she seems to really mean it. And I think that's something that we're all interested and invested in. It's very easy, always in Washington, but in this current news environment, just to get whipsawed by the latest tweet. And she says she would like to steer us away from that, so we'll see.
I should mention, by the way, that we're going to be taking your questions in just a few minutes, so if you have them, who do we have back here who's going to be, Bonnie North is back there raising her hand in the back row. I think she'll be on that microphone, but we'll bring the microphones to you. But I have a few more questions.
Yeah.
And we have somebody else on that microphone. Rachel Owens is on that microphone, or will be. So one of the great good fortunes of this job that I have here is a pretty regular opportunity like this to go out and do events and talk with people who listen every day, or so we hope. When you are operating out of Studio 31 or parachuting in, either physically or literally or metaphorically, how do you gauge...
Metaphorically, yeah. So far.
How do you gauge how you're doing as someone in that situation? Yeah.
This is a good question because I don't get to see the audience every day. And people still write listener letters and call, and now they tweet at us. It's runs as it always has. The people who take the time to write to you are usually outraged and infuriated about something. It runs, you know, a good 60-40 hate mail versus praise, which is fine and as it should be. But yeah, it's hard to know. It's one of the reasons, and I mean this sincerely, that I love getting out and doing events like this and getting to talk to some of you beforehand, and the stories that you're asking me about that register and resonate in your life, that's fascinating to hear. We have some metrics for it, obviously. We can see, you know, on a website who's clicking on things. We can tell when an interview that aired got traction. The Jarl interview, I mean, we got thousands of comments immediately, like within seconds of that airing. But you don't really know, and I particularly feel that when I travel outside the U.S., where it's much less likely that somebody is going to be a regular NPR listener or talk to you. And I'm amazed. The people who will talk to you and tell you their story. I've done several reporting trips to Russia since 2016. If you cover the national security beat, it's been where the action is. The people in Russia who will talk to you, who will sit down, who will pour out their hearts, who will tell their life story with no expectation that they're going to hear it. And, you know, I'm always wary, a little bit of an expectation, is this going to come back to haunt you? If you're telling me how much you hate Vladimir Putin, I get that, you know, this is for an American audience, but you can pull it up anywhere on the web now. Are you okay with this? Let's go back over what you said. I don't know how to explain it, but I will say that the NPR name opens doors worldwide, which is a lovely, gratifying thing. People hear us and they want to engage.
You have interviewed Julian Assange, you have interviewed Jarl Mohn, you've interviewed any number of different people from different walks of life. When are you at your most comfortable doing an interview, and what makes you the least comfortable?
Well, in terms of topics, national security is my sweet spot. I'm, you know, always grabbing all of the foreign policy interviews as they cross. The thing that terrifies me the most is a live NFL interview, to be completely honest, because as my teenage sons would be very quick to tell you, I am completely clueless. It's, you know... It depends how much prep you might get going into any given interview, and it can range from a fabulous producer who's done a very detailed pass-off with suggested questions and suggested follow-ups, and it's beautifully written and it's great, to, you know, nothing in breaking news where, as the line is going up, you've got a producer in your ear saying, his name is Joe, and he's outside the barn. Like, what barn? What city? Where are, who is he? What? Hello, Joe. Welcome to All Things Considered. Tell me your story, Joe. I am pathologically incapable of just reading stuff exactly as scripted, even stuff that I have written. Don't ask me why, but NFL stuff, verbatim. Not, you know, and asking for pronouncers, I'm like, Joe Namath? Like, no. Where's Robert Siegel?
You know, it's funny, I realize as I'm about to ask this question that no one has ever asked me about this same issue, and it's probably unfortunately because I am a man, but you mentioned your teenage sons, and you actually left NPR for a while, both, I gather, to write fiction, but also to be able to spend more time with them. How does the work-life balance play out for you?
God, I mean, if I ever figure it out, I'll let you know. If any of you have the secret, let me know. Yeah, I came back from maternity leave with my, I joined NPR right before 9/11. It's crazy. Was scheduled to go into Iraq for the 2003 US-led invasion and found out I was pregnant. And in a sign of my insanity, actually weighed, like, should I tell NPR or should I just go? Because I wasn't showing yet. And then my husband wisely talked me off that ledge. But I came back from maternity leave and was, you know, right into the thick of it, and then had a second one, second son. They're now in seventh and ninth grade. I mean, it's not, a balancing act is a misnomer. It's like hanging on to a cliff by my toenails every day, which is something probably many people here can relate to. I have hit the wall more than once. Most notably, and the one that led me to leave NPR for a few years, was I was in Iraq, traveling with the then Defense Secretary Bob Gates, and it was a long trip. I think we'd flown in from Amman and gone down to Basra, and we're flying up, and there was a sandstorm coming in, and then, it's a little different now, it's more secure now, but at the time, you would never let a defense secretary drive, even in a secured motorcade, through the streets of Baghdad. So to get to his meetings, he's been helicoptered everywhere. So the press corps that's with him is also being helicoptered, and they do this elaborate choreography where you come in on a military transport plane from wherever you're coming in on. And you'd see, you know, the Blackhawks will be, depending on how big a group it is, 5, 6, 7 of them hovering right above the runway because they want to minimize the time you're on the ground. So the plane touches down, the steps go down, boom, he's out, boom. They leave the press corps to be the last sitting ducks loaded into the last helicopter, which is fair enough. But I'm setting the stage here, you're in full body armor, even inside the green zone, and a helmet and all of that. And I'm waiting my turn to get into a Blackhawk, and the phone rings, and it's the school nurse back in Washington calling to tell me that my four-year-old is in her office, and can I come? That was my reaction. I started laughing and said, you know, lady, if you could see where I am. No, I'm not going to be there. And I'm having trouble hearing her, in part because, you know, it's loud when there's multiple Blackhawks circling around you. And I ask her to yell, and she starts yelling, and she says, I don't mean to pick him up. I mean, he's really sick. He was 4 at the time. He's really sick. I think we need to get him to the hospital. Where are you? And, you know, you immediately stop doing the time zone calculation, thinking, you know, where's the babysitter? Where's my husband? And I lost the line. Cell phone connection is not being great in wartime Iraq. I had no choice but to get in the helicopter and go up. And I had this moment that I will never forget, just sitting sobbing in a helicopter, looking down over the traffic of Baghdad, thinking, what am I doing? I have a 4-year-old. And I love my work, and I have worked really hard to get here, and I think I'm all right at it. And this is not working right now with a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old. And it took me a few months to work up the courage to quit NPR, but I did. I started writing what became my first novel on the plane back to Andrews Air Force Base. And it was a spy novel, the like Write What You Know. The protagonist is a reporter trying to crack a big nuclear terrorism story. And for several years, I wrote and loved it, and it was meaningful, and I saw a lot of my kids, and I was there to do carpool, and I never stopped missing the newsroom. And I kept thinking I would, and I didn't. Every big story that broke, I missed the whole Snowden revelations. I missed it. It killed me. And my breaking point was the Paris terror attacks in 2016, where I had been gone for 3 or 4 years. And my first instinct when that first started breaking was, oh my God, I need to get on a plane to Paris. I speak French. Put me in, coach. I want to go.
That was a football metaphor, by the way.
Thank you. Noted.
I know it was baseball, fine. It's a John Fogerty song, Leave Me Alone.
So that was it. That was late fall of 2015, and I can say that with precision because I called Mike Oreskes, the then head of NPR News, who I'd never met because he came on board while I was gone, and said, I need to come back. You need to hire me back. And he did. And I was back in January of 2016. And in hindsight, although I had no idea what kind of year 2016 was going to be in the news, that was either the worst or the best possible to have gotten back in. But here I am.
So your kids are now 7th and 9th grade. Is it cool for them to have a mom who was host of All Things Considered, or is it less cool?
I think like all 7th and 9th graders, they're 99% oblivious to what I do. My other son, I remember teacher conferences when he was little, and they would say, he seems fine, he's happy and thriving, but he's got a few, he doesn't want to play superheroes on the playground or cowboys and Indians. He wants to play good guys versus Taliban. I'm not making this up. I don't think I've told this story publicly. We got a call, must have been from his second grade teacher, that he was in trouble and, could I come see the teacher at pickup? We went in and she was quite upset and said he got really mad at me because she'd tried to make him, wash his hands before lunch or something. Wicked, obviously. And she said, he started yelling at me and he said, you're meaner than bin Laden. No, you're even meaner than Gaddafi. Right. This is clearly a 7-year-old listening to too much NPR.
Well, with that, this is a great time to outsource these questions. Question in the front row, and then a question in the second row, and then maybe a question in the third row.
Two quick questions. There was a guy here a few years ago that played the harmonica. I can't remember his name, a reporter from...
John Burnett.
You're right. And the question I asked him then, and you don't have to answer this now, but I've got a second quick question, and you know it. I asked him, you guys are great about covering about news that's broken. I'm wondering, what story do you think might be out there that hasn't broken yet? And he said, Venezuela. And so I'm looking to you to look ahead, obviously. The other is, where'd you get that story that you started your second novel with? The Bullet.
Aha. All right. So the first question, just to repeat, what stories are out there that we have no idea about? I mean, this is like welcome to covering the spy beat every day. You know, if you're having a quiet week, you're thinking, I know they're up to something and I have no idea what it is, which is the worst feeling in the world.
Just say the Green Bay Packers.
The Green Bay Packers. Next. I don't have a great answer to that. I wish I could be prophetic like John Burnett, who's wonderful, and it does not surprise me that he pointed to Venezuela. I will say, and this isn't a direct answer to that, but the Mueller investigation, which we can have a debate if y'all want over whether the media got that wrong and over or undercovered it or whatever. But I will say, once we get that, which looks like we're going to get Monday or Tuesday, that story isn't going anywhere, but it will free up phenomenal resources to cover all these other things that have been edged out of the news. I mean, I have had conversations with my colleagues because I was on the Russia investigation beat for a while and never had a day off air. It was just relentless. And colleagues who are covering incredibly important but less, you know, urgent in the daily news cycle beats, like education, you know, climate change, the NFL, you know, we're fighting to get onto air and struggling to do so because there's just, you know, there's only 2 hours of All Things Considered every day. So I don't know what the next Venezuela is going to be, but I'm very much looking forward to having the time to focus on all a little bit more. We'll say that. The second question, which was, what is the story behind the opening scene of my second novel, which is titled The Bullet? And the premise is that a woman finds out she has a bullet lodged in her neck. She's never been shot. How did it get there? And I spin that into 350 pages of fiction. The backstory is it's a true story. I had written my first novel, the one that I started on the way back from Iraq. I could not figure out what the plot of the second novel should be. You know, it's very easy to write a first chapter. You get this great, you know, opening scene, but then where does it go for 400 pages? Like, what's the story? And I was at, which son was it? Oldest son, the now 15-year-old, at his Little League baseball game. And this other mom comes and plops down beside me, a mom who I've met, don't know very well. And I kind of, you know, hey, how you doing? How's your day? She was like, oh, I've had the day from hell, actually. I said, oh, you know, trying to be polite, do tell.
Get your recorder out.
I should have, because she's refused to be interviewed about it since. She wiggles her wrist around and says, I have had for a long time RSI, like carpal tunnel syndrome, pain in my wrist, and they can't figure it out. And so she'd finally been to get an MRI. And as she left the MRI, the technician had chased her out and said, wow, how did you get it? And this woman said, what? And the nurse said, how'd you get it? And this mom said, the what? What are you talking about? And the nurse said, the bullet in your neck, how did you get it? And I look at this woman, said, you're telling me you have an MRI has just shown a bullet in your neck? Yes. That you didn't know was there, correct. This is when the reporter in me kicks in. I'm lifting her hair, looking, is there a scar? You know, have you, we're in Washington, like, I know that you say you're an economist, but have you had some other career, some other government agency you can't talk about? No. She said, have you had amnesia? And she said, how would I know? She has no idea. And she swears she's got a bullet in her neck. And it's in the category of too good to fact check. Like, I'm driving home and then the novelist in me kicks in. I think, how do you get a bullet in your neck and survive and not know? And that's, that little anecdote was almost verbatim my conversation with her, made it, it's the opening 7 pages of the novel, and then it spins into complete fiction, where I make up a hopefully far more horrifying story than whatever happened to her in real life. But I have followed up with her, and she has had subsequent MRIs and CAT scans, and there is what appears to be a half-inch long slug right up against her spine in her neck, and she has no idea how it got there. How can you not get 400 pages out of that? It's great.
Makes a dragon tattoo seem kind of innocuous. I think we had another question.
Both on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, the last few months, you've had this practice where when you're interviewing, say, someone from Congress or from one of the agencies, immediately it's Scott Detrow has been listening in on this conversation, and I think I know why you started this practice, but could you just walk us through what the editorial decision was to start bringing in correspondents to immediately comment on the interviews?
That's a great question. So you're referring to the level set, as we call it, where we have a newsmaker who is live, and immediately follow it by, Scott Detrow, Mara Liasson, Tamara Keith has been listening in. What'd you hear? What struck you? And they'll do just a very quick, it's a fact check, basically. Morning Edition pioneered it. All Things Considered has done it less, in part because Morning Edition has been more aggressively live than All Things Considered. Average All Things Considered, average, typical day, there might be, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 live interviews out of a total of 10, 11, 12, so the, you know, maybe slightly less than half are live. Morning Edition, in part because of their schedule, just, you know, the hosts are there at 3 in the morning. It's hard to find a White House official who's, you know, going to pre-tape by the time they need to go home, so it's live. We started doing it because, by definition, when, as an anchor, I'm interviewing somebody who's an expert. I'm asking them because they know more about the subject than I do. And it's almost impossible to fact check everything live in real time. A correspondent who's covering that beat full time has a better shot at it. So a Scott Detrow, if you're interviewing a member of Congress, a John Burnett, if it's, you know, an official talking about immigration policy, who can say, you know, those numbers actually are very different from where they were last year, or actually those numbers aren't the ones that we have found when we fact-checked or whatever. I think there are days when that adds great value. Days where it maybe doesn't. Days where I've wished I have had it when I have been interviewing certain officials live and they throw out 7, 8, 9 things at once that you're frantically rushing to fact check and follow up and give context and nuance, but you also need to follow up on something else they said earlier, and there's this other really important thing you got to get to, and you've got 40 seconds left and you got to be out. Like, what do you do? And it is useful to have someone who's listening in and can give a little bit of context and perspective, but that's the thinking about it. We are doing more live interviews than we did 2 years ago, certainly more than 5 years ago. Partly that's the news cycle. It's just impossible to record with a newsmaker and expect it to stand up, you know, 6, 8 hours later. It's just going to be overtaken by events, so you book them live. It also, you know, the pros and cons of editing, if you edit, you can edit for clarity. You can distill a verbose anecdote to make it much shorter, but preserve the central thrust of it. If you're really in a combative interview, though, there's a virtue to having every single thing said. So they can't come back and say, you took me out of context, you edited out the key example. I'm like, well, it was the 7th one you gave. So you know, you had a chance to make your point. It is what it is, and the audience gets to hear every word and judge what you think. But that's the thinking.
People on this side are also allowed to ask questions.
What do your foreign intelligence antennae tell you is going to happen with this strange dance we've been watching between Trump and Kim Jong-un of North Korea? They were at it again today with blowing kisses, and it just strikes me as very strange, and I'd be interested in what you think is going to happen.
Yeah. You may know more than I do about what happened today with the South Korean president who's been in town. I have not been, obviously, on air and tracking that today because I've been here talking to you all. you know, the two summits that they have had thus far, and the White House says that they are, Pompeo says that they will have another one, and they're laying the groundwork for that. I mean, I suppose that the central question is, we know what the U.S. wants. You can like or dislike Trump's approach, think he gives away too much, doesn't lay the groundwork in these summits, but what the U.S. wants is pretty clear and consistent. The U.S. would like complete, verifiable, irreversible disarmament of nuclear weapons by North Korea. What North Korea wants is considerably more opaque to me. Kim Jong-un wants to stay in power, wants the regime to persevere. It was fascinating to me reporting from there this past fall. I was expecting to go in and have a lot of interviews to do with the nuclear program, and they wouldn't give me any, not one. Not because of the secrecy of the program, but because it was not the agenda. Kim Jong-un came out last year and said, we have fulfilled our nuclear ambitions. We have an operational weapon. We've got what we need. We're good. Setting that aside, now we're focused on the economy. And every single interview that I was doing there had to do with, they would take us to a factory, they would take us to a farm, they would take us to the markets. They, you know, it was all about growth and the economy, and the impact of sanctions was where the focus is now. So I don't know. I don't think anybody, including Trump and Kim Jong-un, know where this goes next. Are we in a better place than we were when I was applying for visas at this time last year? Absolutely. You can give Trump credit for that or not. You can argue that he, through these summits and through his approach, has walked us back from a crisis that was largely of his own making. The whole, whose nuclear button is bigger rhetoric and all of that. I don't know where it goes next. My hope is that there is a moment and there's a little bit of space for negotiators and seasoned diplomats to go in and try to make some kind of progress. The flip side is that the President of the United States has now sat down twice with the leader of North Korea. Why has he done that? Does he meet with any other leader of a country of 25 million people, I think, North Korea, with an economy their size? He's doing it because they have nuclear weapons and the threat that poses. And by sitting down with them, it becomes a tacit acknowledgement that they are a nuclear power, and it becomes harder and harder to walk that back and pretend that there's any way that that will not be the case going forward. I don't quite know where it goes next.
How do you manage to keep your personal beliefs and opinions out of your interviews? And are there some situations where you don't try to do that?
I think, I'm trying to think of the clearest way to answer that. I don't feel like I'm doing battle with myself, stifling down my deeply held views that I would love to be able to share on air. If you come to a job like I have, and I'm lucky to have, it's because you actually like to talk to a lot of people with views all over the map, and you want to hear what they have to say. When I invite somebody to come on All Things Considered and talk to me, it's my job to ask them hopefully rigorous, persistent questions, but also to give them the space to answer it. Because if I invite you on, it's because we want to hear what you have to say. It's funny, and it's something that I am trying to be better about, is being transparent on air, on Twitter, on the website, about how we make the decisions we make about who we interview and what questions we pose, because I know that we're trying to reach people from all across the spectrum. I know that, you know, if I just interviewed three Republicans today, I probably interviewed three Democrats yesterday, and we're trying, there's not a, you know, not like we're comparing minute for minute, but that there's a balance and a depth and breadth of voices who we're talking to. But I get just furious phone calls and emails if I've just been, you know, done a fairly aggressive interview with a Democrat, and they say, you never would ask a Republican that. And I'd say, really? Like, look at these three interviews we did yesterday. You know, come back. And that same thing. People, very few of us have the luxury of listening to the full 2 hours every day and the full however many hours every week and every month. You know, I see it as my job just to be curious, to ask a lot of questions, to try to be fair and tough on everybody and figure somewhere or the other it balances out. It's in this current administration challenging in a way that I have not experienced before. I've only lived in Washington under three presidents, Bush, Obama, and now Trump. And again, it's, you know, always a huge range of views, and it's not like there are two sides to any given story because there are infinite sides usually, but it used to be that if you got a Republican on and a Democrat on, they would disagree. They would, you know, for the most part, to the party line, you kind of, they were balancing each other out. It is often hard now to book, often the people who are most critical of Trump on our air are Republicans. We've had challenges in the regular Week in Politics segment where we have, it's usually David Brooks and E.J. Dionne on because they are both intensely critical of Trump. And you feel like we need to bring on like the third party voice or something, that, you know, somebody bringing that perspective to the air. But yeah, I feel like I'm fumbling around a little bit trying to answer your question, but it's not trying to dodge it. I just genuinely don't feel like I wrestle with that. I do wrestle with when I feel like somebody isn't telling me the truth. And that's not a partisan thing or a political thing, but when I feel like somebody is saying something that is just not supported by facts, that riles me up. And that's when you will hear me really digging in and pushing on somebody hard. And it's not because I disagree with their views, but I disagree with something that is divorced from fact-based reality.
We have time for two, maybe three more questions.
Thanks. Do you want an intelligence question or an NPR question?
Lay them on me. Let's see.
So my intelligence question would be, there's reporting about, in the State Department, for example, the efflux of career diplomats and has been worrisome. Is the same thing happening in the intelligence community?
Well, we don't really know because it's not public. The CIA does not disclose even a top line, their budget. We get the overall budget of the non-military intelligence programs versus military intelligence. They don't disclose how many people work there, even, I mean, roughly 20-something thousand. We recently interviewed the general counsel of the National Security Agency, Glenn Gerstel, who gave the first time I've ever heard an official on the record talk about, he said, the 45-something thousand who work at NSA. And I went, wow, like, you're not really supposed to tell me that. Go on. The point being, it's not a matter of public record the way it is at state when people are coming and going. There have been a few high-profile, I'm going to die on this mountain resignations who have resigned and then written op-eds. We have obviously all followed John Brennan and some of the other former intelligence officials who have spoken up loudly, publicly, repeatedly with criticisms of this administration and the relationship between the White House and the intelligence agencies that serve it. My sense from reporting on, say, the CIA is that it has calmed down a little bit under Gina Haspel, the current director. And I say that in part, they're out of the headlines. I think I've covered the confirmation hearing of every CIA director since 2001, and there have been, I don't know, six or seven in that period, and they all come in vowing to, you know, return the CIA to its secret clandestine roots and get the CIA off the front pages and focus on the core mission of espionage, et cetera. They all say it. Gina Haspel has actually done it. She is the first female director of the agency. She is the first actual career spy to run the agency. Porter Goss, very early in his career before he moved on to other things and eventually to Congress and chairing the Intelligence Committee in the House, worked at CIA. John Brennan was a career analyst, different thing. She's the first career operations officer to run it, and so she only came out from undercover very recently. You Googled her before and you would come up with nothing. No public footprint. The point being, she has never given an interview to any journalist ever. That trickles down through the ranks. She has gone on to a point, it's incredible, the head of the clandestine service, the head of the analysis, and the head of science and technology, the three main directorates of the CIA are now all run by women. The general counsel of the CIA is a woman. You never hear about it. It's there off the radar. We never know what we don't know. To the question of like, what's the big story waiting to break that we'll all be talking about a year or two from now? Certainly at the CIA, you don't know what's happening behind the scenes, and I don't have my finger on it in the way that I once did now that I'm anchoring full-time. But my sense is that morale there has stabilized. She's just very out of the public limelight, both off the front pages, off our air, not giving interviews, and keeping her head down. Her point would be emphasizing, focusing on the mission. So I think it's a little bit of a different thing. They're just not out in the public eye the way that the State Department has been of late.
Time for maybe another two questions here.
Thank you. So you lamented, I think, that the Mueller investigation has sort of sucked the air out of the room as far as doing a lot of other important stories. And I'm wondering, why is that the case? Why can't we say, gee, this is the 16th time we've talked to one other minor person in this investigation. How about if we talk about a major part of another story? But it feels like we can't because we have to spend our time on the Mueller investigation. Who makes the decision that maybe we could cover something else that you think is important? And then I guess, why do they generally opt to do what everybody else is doing, especially at NPR, where you're not really driven by needing to have ad revenue or something else that's going to reward you for pandering, I guess, be a good word.
Right. So if I understood your question, it's why do you have to cover every twist and turn and tiny development in the Mueller probe at the expense of covering other things? Why can't you make a decision not to follow the pack and do something else? Is that the gist of what you're getting at? Yeah. The short answer is, absolutely. This is a conversation we have every day, starting in the 9:30 editorial meeting where all the editors and producers and the staff of All Things Considered gets together and we're planning what the show should look like that night. It's a great meeting because it's super ambitious, because at 9:30 in the morning, like, the world is your oyster. Aim high, get anything you want. Why not? We'll see what we can pull together. And I mention that because the 9:30 meeting is like the dream ATC show you always wanted to hear. It's, you know, who's the greatest voice we could get? Aim high, get that person, get this person, get this person. And the day unfolds and the tweets start coming in and you think, that's an interesting thing to tweet. To take a random example, the threat last week to shut the US-Mexico border. You can't ignore it. It's the president of the United States threatening to shut the border. I mean, that's an extreme example, but there's like half a dozen a day where you think we can't just let that go by unnoticed. It needs to be fact-checked. We need to look at the implications. We need to investigate, is this a real proposal? Is this real? Or is this, you know, a thought that, you know, was tweeted and is not, in fact, the direction the administration's passing, you know, planning to go, but that takes time to tease that out, both in terms of our reporting resources and in terms of, okay, if we make time for that, then there, it's a finite two-hour show, which is a long time, but not infinite. And if we make time to do that, then we're not going to have time for this other story that we all thought at 9:30 was really interesting. Yeah. You could fill those 2 hours every single day with big Washington policy and politics stories that merit coverage. Obviously, we don't do that. Obviously, we're triaging every day and sometimes getting those calls right and other times not. The Mueller investigation is an interesting one where we couldn't ignore it, you know. You know, the Washington press corps didn't ignore, you know, Watergate during the Nixon administration. You can't, it's a huge story with so many implications that we didn't invent. There's been a lot of commentary in these last few weeks that the media got it completely wrong and made this up and spent, you know, all this time the dog chasing its tail and it's all, you know, been fake news. Well, there are things the media could have done better, no question. You know, scoops that have had to be retracted. Panels of talking heads who had zero information because the Mueller team didn't leak, holding forth every night on cable news, and to be honest, on NPR news programs. Was that the best use of our time on any given day? You can go back and argue that. That said, a couple of things. One is, again, we didn't invent this. The then Republican-led House and Senate Intelligence Committees launched investigations into this. Trump's own Justice Department appointed a special counsel. You can't ignore it. And setting aside the politics, you know, take the whole obstruction of justice and what happened after the election out of it. Take whether there was collusion or not out of it. And Mueller found there wasn't evidence that led to him thinking that legal charges were in order. This was a foreign adversary seeking to subvert the U.S. presidential election. That's at the core of our democracy, and I don't quite know how you can overcover that. It matters, whatever your politics. The flip side, I was saying this to someone today, it might have been you when we were chatting in your office, Mitch. When I think about conversations I have had that will stick with me, that I feel like advanced the national understanding of a story in some way. Some of them have had to do with our Mueller coverage. Very rarely is it, you know, my 4-minute live interview with Mara Liasson or Scott Horsley telling me, you know, the latest tweet out of the White House. Not to diss any of our fabulous Washington desk reporters, but like, is that gonna be the memorable thing that I really, you know, need? Could that have just been a little mention in the newscast, and then we all moved on. And we do talk about that, and think about particularly because we get to do it all again in the run-up to 2020. How do we want to cover that race? I know that gets away. I mean, covering polls at this point is so meaningless. How do we distribute our resources to cover that race in a way that distinguishes us from the gazillion other newsrooms doing it? Morning Edition, to give credit where credit is due, has had a series of excellent conversations with a lot of the Democratic candidates so far and given them space and time and talked policy. Not gotten into, you know, Washington politics, but really, like, what's your great big hope? What's the plan? And those, I thought, have been actually riveting radio. So doing things like that is, I hope, and my intention is that is when I'm back from book leave, what I hope to be working on in this summer and fall going forward.
I think we have time for one last question. A lot of pressure on you.
Okay, my question is, we've been seeing all this thing about the immigration of people at the border that can't get in, the kids being separated from their parents. And my question is, the obvious solution to this is, instead of jailing the immigrants, why don't we jail the people that hire them? I mean, if you want to solve the whole problem, all you got to do is stop the incentive. And the stopped incentive is to jail the people that hire these people. Like just in Texas, they arrested 280 people the other day. They would have had a much more effective account if they arrested the 15 people that hired them. And like I said, the people that are coming here are coming for the same reason my grandfather came here, my great-grandfather. They came for a better life and better things. And my wife is telling me to shut up, so.
You want to comment on the part that where his wife tells him? No, not.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, your question prompts me to feel the relief I feel almost daily that it's my job to ask questions about how we fix this and not to try to actually, it's not my job to prescribe what the policy is to fix it. I don't know the answer to how we fix what's happening at the border. It is my job to ask the questions to the people who are in a position of power to do something about that or to challenge what's happening at the border and to try to tease out what are the pros and cons of the various policies that have been floated, proposed, implemented, rolled back, et cetera. This gets back, I guess, to the very first question, what's the big story. I guess if you've tracked the Trump campaign closely back in 2015, 2016, you could have seen that his was going to have a laser focus on immigration. And he has, it's clearly been the defining issue of his presidency and presumably will be going into the 2020 campaign. Again, I mean, not my job to weigh in on who we should be arresting or not and what the policy is, but that along with, the Mueller story, the Washington stories that we're covering to try to figure out how do we cover this story in which there is a lot of false information circulating, massive confusion about what policies the U.S. is pursuing and should pursue, and try to figure out what coverage conversations and how can we deploy our resources to try to bring information to all of you and put the tough questions to the people who are determining this. How can we do that in a way that's compelling and moves the story forward? What we're going out trying to do every day.
I feel like I want to end this on a slightly different note. You are currently on leave to work on your third novel. I won't ask you to preview that novel because I know it's at a fairly early point. But I would like you to, if you would, recommend a recent book that you have read.
Ah. thriller genre or otherwise?
Thriller, French literature, whatever. Maybe some Camus.
I did, yeah. Well, my degree's in French literature, so we could be here for a while. I'm pausing because there's just so many that I would recommend. If you haven't read, this is very much in my wheelhouse, but a trilogy of three Russian spy novels by a former CIA operations officer, who I'm stalling because his name is floating through my head and then disappearing. I want to say Jason Goodwin. Wish I had my phone, I could quickly fact check this. Red Sparrow, it's been made into a movie, the first one. The books are so much better than the movie. And they're lovely for a couple of things. One is you can feel the actual knowledge informing them. They're great reads. He also does a little thing that sounds like a gimmick, but that is fun. Almost every chapter has some random reference to food. You know, the protagonist will be trying to recruit a source at a cocktail party, and the waitress comes by and offers the, you know, curdled carrot canapé. And they move on, but at the end is the recipe for, you know, the Czech embassy's curdled carrot canapé. And every single one is like that. And it's good fun and as realistic as a spy novel ever really is. But Putin is a protagonist in part of these. So they're very current. And they're great fun. And I would recommend them. Thank you. Jason Matthews. Thank you.
Well, I want to close by saying, first of all, I think everyone in this room thinks of you, Mary Louise Kelly, as a rock star in our world. I also... I also want to close by acknowledging that all of you in this room are rock stars in our world, because without you, we would not be sitting up here having this conversation. So I really... I would give you a hand, but I dropped the mic. But give yourselves a hand. Thank you to all the members of the WUWM staff that have been here and made this event possible tonight. Thank you so much to the staff here for doing such a wonderful job. It is a beautiful room. I hope many of you brought umbrellas with you, because it does appear to be raining. I hope you'll come back and see us again and keep listening. Thank you so much. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.